If you're like most CISOs, you're trying to manage a number of tools to go ahead and protect your enterprise. But the real thing you're trying to protect are not the tools themselves or applications, but the data itself. So we're going to talk with a couple experts today about data-centric security and how you can learn from them to improve your cybersecurity. Hello and welcome to another episode of CISO Tradecraft, the podcast that provides you with the information, knowledge, and wisdom to be a more effective cybersecurity leader. My name is G. Mark Hardy. I'm your host for today, and we are going to be talking about cybersecurity from a particular perspective, and that is of data-centric security strategy rather than a product-centric security strategy. See, in 2026, we're facing a surge of AI-powered threats, and common element across all of them is they're targeting sensitive or critical data. I mean, let's face it, nobody's going to mount a cyber attack to steal a copy of Microsoft Word. It's likely a desire to exfil your information for resale or extortion payment, deny your company access to its own critical information, think ransomware, or even using it as leverage. We've seen some bad actors that are going ahead and said, hey, if you don't go ahead and pay our ransom, we're going to go ahead and sick the regulatory authorities on you because they will impose a fine on you. So here's the problem. When attacks are moving at the speed of AI, we as defenders can't be poking around with multiple product solutions trying to stitch them together in real time to respond to the threat. We shouldn't have to be our own systems integrator to effectively secure our enterprise. So to discuss this topic today, we've got EJ Pappas, Ed Ross Young. EJ, it's good to have you on the show. And could you share a little bit about your background for the others? And of course, we'll do Ross, but a lot of people are already familiar with Ross.
Thanks, G-Mark. I'm EJ Pappas. I am the field CTO for PKWare company. PKWare is PKWare, the founder of the ZIP standard, the ZIP encryption format.
As I recall.
That's right.
I remember corresponding with him, believe it or not, in the late 1980s. Sorry to take a detour, but yeah, you guys have been around a long, long time. And he was quite famous at the time for his data compression software. That's what we really got to start out with.
Indeed we were. So PKWare has been on that journey for close to that 40-year mark that we've been talking about, moving from that compression utility to a foundation now based on discovery and protections, of course, including encryption, but through many other mediations that we'll probably talk about here today. I've been at PKWare for 18 years, and aside from being the field CTO, I manage 11 of our largest accounts, mostly in heavily regulated banking, financial services, and insurance organizations.
Fascinating. So that's a great long run with the company. So congratulations both for you and the company culture, which allows that recognition of merit to continue. Now, one of the things we talk about is on background, you know, data security. It started out, as I said, Phil Katz doing the data compression. He used to have the PK ZIP. Mm-hmm. And as just kind of finished my story. So back in 1989, I think it was, I was working with a client and we were writing software and we would ship it on 6 different floppies, 5 1/4-inch floppies. And I said, this is ridiculous. We could fit them all in one floppy if we could use this. So I got a hold of him and I said, hey, can we cut a deal where instead of just a single license, we can go ahead and use it over and over again. And I think we settled on the astronomical sum of $100 to get an unlimited license to do so. And believe it or not, the marketing guy objected because he's going to say, people are going to think they're not getting their money's worth if they're only getting one floppy disk in the mail instead of 6. So we need to send, I said, we'll send them 1 and 5 blanks just in case. But I ended up winning that argument. We did end up using the PKWare. But fast forward now. So let's start kind of with the big picture. We look at data and data security, of course, and that's what you guys are focused on. But for a lot of us as CISOs, we invest in the concept of perimeter security. At least that's what we're doing back in the 1990s and 2000s. And then we had to go to endpoint security. And then we're finding out we got to go to cloud security. Well, really, it turns out the common element across all of those is we're trying to protect the data. Is data really our true battlefield? And we've just been fighting these other types of skirmishes to be able to, you know, essentially protect what ultimately is what we're really all about here.
I think that data is, and I believe that the reason that we have landed on data, or the industry has landed on data, is because traditional notions of protection have always been outside in. We have been kind of digging moats, building fences, putting sentries on turrets to make sure that the data on egress was being was being protected. We were worrying about keeping the bad guys out and providing layers of protection so that that information was being that you felt that you were being safe with your information because you had layered your protection in such a way. But in reality, we've always been worrying about the data itself. We've always been worried about the asset that we have been protecting was in fact the data. And so the concept of data-centric protection or data protection, the notion is that if you can provide the protection as close to the data as possible, then the rest of the information is safer within your organization, or that your organization in fact is safer because you've kind of removed the burden and notion of motion being the variable that causes chaos and pain within your organization. So being data centric in your behavior means that you are thinking about your information first and worrying about your infrastructure second.
It's kind of interesting because as a student of military history and a participant of it for a long time, you usually try to go ahead and move your defenses out as far as you possibly can. So you've got room to fall back if necessary. Mm-hmm. But the suggestion here in the data-centric security means that might not matter if you can go ahead and tuck your defenses right around your information and it travels in a phalanx of protection. We don't really care about that other stuff. Is that an accurate characterization?
Well, I do. I think that in your military notion, I would say that, you know, you always kept the generals back as far as away from the line as you could, because you were trying to protect that valuable asset by keeping it as far back as possible. I think the data centric security is really about assurance. I think that that is really what we're trying to do. We're trying to understand where your data lives. We're trying to understand what information that you happen to be storing. We're trying to understand who is accessing that data, where you're sending it, or where you're sending it, where you're taking it in from, or where you're sending it to. Mm-hmm. And so, because data is the most important component of your organization, that information is the most important. What you're the way that you can reduce your material risk is by providing the clearest path to failure, by removing the clearest path to failure by protecting that information itself. So we feel like having knowledge of your data first, and then putting protection around that data based on where it lives, removes that burden of, oops, I sent it to the wrong place. Wow, I gave access to the wrong user or to the wrong group. And the focus then becomes, nobody has ever said, oops, I changed access. And that got reported in the paper. It's I changed access and my data got stolen, or my data got stolen.
Very, very, very good point. Yeah. And in fact, we'll talk a little bit more about compliance in a little bit later. But here's a thought. Why do we still struggle to answer the question, where is our sensitive data? Because it's a predicate to being able to do the strategy you talked about. If we know it's somewhere in the enterprise, then you just set up this big, huge perimeter defense and hope for the best. But if we're going to be pulling these defenses back closer to the data, we need to know where the sensitive data is. Why is this such a difficult question to answer accurately?
I think you started this conversation and you talked about endpoints and file servers, and then you talked about cloud. Mm-hmm. And you talked about some other, newer notions of where data is. I think the simple reason is that data lives in too many places now. So data is in so many places within your organization. And because it's in so many places, you have so many data owners. So it's no longer a singular organization that has an ability to make dictatorial decisions around what they're going to do with the data, who is going to have access to that data, and how it's going to be gone. So since data is the asset, data is the value, the owners of that asset and the value are spread across your organization, and therefore the risk around access to that data becomes that much more heightened. Traditional or organizational views of people have viewed data based on location attribute versus based on value. So people would say, I've got an Azure cloud that has card data versus I have card data that happens to be stored in Azure. So the difference for me is looking at the data in a holistic way versus if you look at the data in a holistic way, I'm worrying about where my sensitive data is living. I'm worrying about where my card data or my social security numbers are living. Then you reduce your ability to hit the gaps, right? There, now we're not worrying about the gaps between the protections, the gaps between the organizations, the gaps that fit within your data organization.
Interesting. So we've really kind of shifted from server to cloud, cloud to software as a service providers like Microsoft, Office Suite 365 and things like that. Mm-hmm. Is that just the main driver? Is there something else happening other than the fact that we're just kind of getting rid of the perimeter and we're trusting more and more places?
Well, I think we're all old enough on the call so or that I can say this, is that I believe this is sort of the Radio Shacking of your operations and infrastructure teams. So, you know, the good old days of Radio Shack is you can go, I'm not going to go to the store and buy a computer. I'm going to go to the store and buy the parts of the computer. I'm going to piece it all together and I'll put it together in my basement and I'll plug it and solder it and do whatever that happens to be. So today, organizations say, I'm going to store user data in SharePoint.
Mm-hmm.
Great. It's now in SharePoint. It's not on my endpoint. It's on my hard drives. I don't have to worry about it there. You know what? I'm not going to store it in SharePoint because my Microsoft deal isn't the best deal that I found on storage. I'm going to go to Amazon. So I'm going to use an S3 bucket because that's the cheapest storage that I can find. So I move that data to Amazon and worried about where that happens to be. We are saving money on the pieces and parts and not worrying about the working together. Not worrying about security or compliance, because that's the last piece of that part of the story. The MSP doesn't care. The cloud provider doesn't care about security. They call that a shared responsibility in their SLAs. So that becomes my burden. It's not where that data happens to be stored. And so I think that really is the biggest driver in terms of the, you know, why the data sprawl is so great and why people don't know where your data happens to be.
Interesting. So we've got the shared responsibility model of cloud providers. Okay, we protect, we keep the power going. We'll make sure that the system is up and running, but you own the data inside. And if you lose your keys or things such as that, it's on you, the customer. But that's just where we store it. Why do you think data security historically has been so fragmented across a whole bunch of multiple tools?
I think the biggest problem with the tools is that we have grown in an industry where the next new place to store your data created its own set of tools. So mainframes, when data lived on mainframes, there were a series of tools that worried about the mainframe and you worried about discovery or protection or whatever the story was on your mainframe. Then the data moved to your file servers and it became this is a Windows solution, or this is a Linux solution, or this happens, it's on Macs. So the Macs don't talk to my Windows machines, and those Macs certainly aren't going to be talking to my mainframe. So what happens is that platforms became the source, ground zero for the tool set. And nobody looked at this as an opportunity to say, let's have one product that looks across, that the targets are merely incidental to the overall data story. So you know, at PKWare, we have a discovery tool that allows me to say, I can look at any one of those things, and that becomes the story. The story is your product doesn't cover enough of the targets, not I don't have a product to cover the target. So it's that kind of the chicken and egg. And I think, Mark, the other issue that is a problem is that people have looked at structured or unstructured data in different ways. People have thought about them as, although the data themselves is different, they're thinking behaviorally that they have to worry about something else. So to me, in a structured file has columns and rows, generally speaking, it sits statically at an environment and you worry about access to that environment. Unstructured files are created dynamically by individual users and then shared across your organization. So since they're so different, how could you possibly look at them the same way? Well, if they're PCI, or if they're HIPAA, or if they're covering some level of governance, they all apply to the same. So the rules are the rules, and you need to be able to apply those rules across the various sets that you happen to have. So I think that that's really where the challenge comes, is that people don't look at the organization as a problem to solve. They look at it as a platform to solve.
Very interesting. So if platform is a problem, maybe we'll go ahead and create that new acronym here.
There you go.
But what we find then is if we've been trying to protect our systems, as you indicated, by diversifying the types of endpoints we had, the types of perhaps databases, even the SaaS tools we have, mm-hmm. require different tool sets simply because one vendors would specialize in something like that. And ideally, in a perfect world, somebody like Apple or Microsoft or Amazon would say, hey, we've invented every possible security feature you need. It's organic. It's in version 1.0. Well, that doesn't happen. But we seem to be that the wiser thing is to move from protecting systems, from orchestrating a whole set of these different tool sets out there, which are really sort of a symptom of having this heterogeneous environment, to protecting information as being the key element. So if we think of that as a strategic imperative and maybe a rewording of our strategic imperative to protect information, what does that actually involve for security leaders? Do we have to communicate something different to our boards and even to our staffs? Or is that going to be just a, yep, we'll just change the label and everybody's happy with it?
Well, I think the movement of protecting systems to protecting data, that movement is happening, but it's slow and it's begrudgingly happened. And I think that it's slow because the metrics on proving that you're being successful at this are harder to ascertain. It's easier to say, I have fortified my S3 environment. I have put transparent encryption on my file servers, and I have reduced the access controls to my Active Directory. Those are easy things to be able to, hard things to implement. I'm not being casual about it, but it's easy to be able to say that I've done those things versus I have reduced my attack surface of my data because I have provided I'm using encryption as a method to store all of my protected assets. So I think that number one, it's difficult to talk to your boards in that way because, you know, the material risks are the only things that you can kind of worry about. The rest of those risks become math problems. Somebody I read talked about math problems with providing board information. And I think that that's the key for us, is that we have to be able to provide ways of saying, I have this amount of data, I am protecting it in this kind of way. So it is, you know, using, you know, when I talk about protection, classification is a method to get to protection, but classification isn't a protection. Classification merely tells me what is important or not important in my environment. Encryption is a method, but not the only method. Redaction is a method. Obfuscation is a method. Masking is a method. You know, deletion is a method. There's all kinds of ways that you can use. And I think those capabilities in concert are things that you can report and talk to your boards about, because that tells you, we don't have data that's older than 7 years old in our company, or we don't have data that is utilized by people outside of this group, or our access control is based on behavior, not based on location. So I think that that's really the best way of that's the best way of reporting that information. And it's the healthiest way of being able to view the information, and the information being the data inside of your organization, to be able to provide comfort, you know, assurance and kind of visibility to what's happening.
So you got a lot of great ideas there. Let me try to stitch them together and see if I could make this into a coherent statement. If I, as a CISO, are going to be talking to the board about protecting information, I might start with something such as compliance, if that's a concern of theirs, to say we have these different compliance requirements. To meet those compliance requirements, we need certain technologies that are going to give us the capability. But instead of just protecting the platform, the network, the carrier, if you will, that the information is flowing, we're going to focus on protecting the information itself, because that is where our capabilities lie. It's also where our vulnerabilities lie. Nobody has to file if somebody steals an empty hard drive. Nobody has to file something if they go ahead and destroy an old computer. But there is problems with the information. So by focusing on that, we have a more cohesive program that is going to allow us to not only meet our compliance requirements, but enhance our resiliency, resist our ability to be potentially compromised in something like a ransomware attack, because if the data is encrypted, and even if they got it, they can't do anything with it anyway. So we consider ourselves to be well defended. Something along those lines?
I do. I agree with almost everything you said.
Good. This is that's sort of back and forth here.
The one part I always take pause to is that I do think that a lot of CISOs worry about compliance,
mm-hmm.
and they don't necessarily worry about protection. So compliance is the checkbox,
right?
That got me through the audit. Protection is the method that keeps me out of the paper, right? Keeps me off the front page,
and it also keeps me operationally effective, because at the end of the day, we're not really the department of no, we're the department of how. And as Ross likes to say, we have to be in the business of revenue protection. We're in the business of revenue protection when we ensure that operations continue uninterrupted. And that's really the true metric, is did IT security enable us to go ahead and allow the organization, in spite of any risks, threats, or outside or even inside problems, to continue to deliver to their customers, to their shareholders, to their employees?
Agreed. I totally agree.
So we put all this together. What do you think a world-class data security program would look like today?
I think it starts inside out, as I kind of said at the beginning. So I think it's focused on the data first, where that data is created, where it lives and breathes inside of your organization, identifying it at its inception. So at creation and, you know, at first start, you identify what data is sensitive, what data isn't sensitive. You protect it as it's being created. So you know that, I know that PCI data can't live on an endpoint. So therefore, if I find data in a downloads folder, I either redact that instantly or I move it to a secure location so that my user doesn't get a chance to make a bad decision. I think you understand, a data security program today should understand where data is being sent to, where it's being consumed by the organization, and where applications, you know, what the application's inputs and outputs are, because really it is not about, I think, you know, traditionally we have worried about where data rests, and I think that we should be worrying about where data moves, and rest should be the last stop in that particular data protection, data security journey.
All right. Sounds good. Yeah. And typically we do have requirements for data at rest, data in motion, and that's a common sense. Well, let's move on a little bit and let me expand the discussion a little bit to talk about the concept of vendor sprawl. So in data security, you might see that we're going to buy a data loss protection, a DLP, a data security posture management, a DSPM, encryption tools, key management, maybe tools even generate test data that doesn't have anything to do with our real data, because we all know that you don't protect test data. That's just what happens. Why do you think the market has evolved in this way in terms of the sprawl instead of somebody just hanging out a shingle saying, get it all here under one roof?
I think first, the real reason is that organizations didn't start with a view of data. I think they've been starting with a view of locations and starting with a view of particular kind of tasks around that. So people have confused, you talked about motion and emotion and at rest. I think that people have confused encrypted transport with data protection, right? Mm-hmm. Transport is merely the secure means of moving unprotected data from one source to another, which provides you comfort, but doesn't tell you where the data had started and doesn't tell you where the data ended. And I think, data sprawl, when you talk about like key management and encryption systems, those are characteristics to your data solution. Those are not the solution itself. So those are all kind of appetites. I think that CISOs and security leaders become intoxicated by a component of security. We're living right now in this age of worrying about quantum, right? So I certainly need to be able to support quantum technology. Quantum is a method to ensure that the data that I have identified as sensitive and I am deciding to encrypt is going to be encrypted in a way that will not be able to be broken. So like that is the last leg of that journey. It's not, I'm going to apply quantum protections across my organization. It's the how are you going to do that and why are you doing that and what that method happens to be, I think, becomes the important part of that.
Got it. So, you know, since we sort of inherited this model, we end up having a little bit here, a little bit here. As you said, we sort of evolved and we didn't really focus on the data at first. But does this create overlapping coverage, at which point we can sit back and say, hey, we're doing well? Or do you think it has a tendency to create blind spots where we might miss something, but we think we've got it covered because, by golly, look at that Excel spreadsheet. Look at all these tools I have. One of them's got to be covering it. What do you think?
I think that you can't fall in love with a single characteristic. So I think that, you know, having more than one is okay, but one size doesn't fit all in terms of that kind of notion. I think that data protection is about classification and sensitivity labels and encryption and masking and obfuscation and redaction and all sorts of components that you are going to put together in a holistic data sense. And if you return from that, if you're worrying about those blind spots, if you return to the beginning of this conversation that we've been having today around data centricity, I think that if your first focus is on understanding what data you have and where that data is and where it's going, you are eliminating blind spots because you're anticipating that the data is going to move and that the data is not going to be in one spot. Users aren't just coming to the data is going to your users. And therefore, you, if you're thinking about it in that way, you can kind of remove those blind spots from your, we don't get to have the beeping sounds from our cars, right?
Right. Where is it? Then we find it. So what we have then is kind of a bit of a struggle. We've got multiple vendors, each of which may have point solutions. They might be excellent point solutions. And in the military, we used to call different groups that didn't talk to each other but did their jobs well, silos of excellence. We stayed within our own silo, but we didn't play well with others. And that was really kind of the genesis of the Department of Homeland Security when they had all these different, you know, the IC just didn't play well with each other. They might still not today, but at least they're under the same roof. But I digress. But if we take a look here, what do you think for an organization that has a more mature approach? They said, okay, we figured this out. We get that. We're focusing on data-centric. Is there a common data security mistake that these organizations make? And if so, what could they do about it?
I think there is. So first, to answer your question, yes, I think that there is a common mistake. I think the first mistake is that they're a hammer looking for a nail a lot of times in this notion. So I have a solution and let me show you how my solution can be applied across these various pieces. So, you know, you can't have a solution unless you know what your data is. So it's not, you can't buy the greatest car unless you know what, you know, if you're trying to drive on the beach, then, you know, having the fastest sports car doesn't work within that way. So I think that the primary notion or obstacle that most organizations have is that they forget that reporting provides visibility to an organization, which then leads to where your problems are, which then lead to where your solutions can be. So the first thing you need to have is visibility. I think people skip the concept of visibility and move towards a solution that they have used before or heard about or think's going to solve a particular instance. And we're living at the advent right now, Mark, of the ultimate solution to every problem in the world called AI, which will then address all of the common ills of the world. And we don't have to worry about anything anymore because it's going to magically, that's the elixir that happens. So if you get intoxicated by a solution, you're going to cause yourself a problem.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think we fall in love with these things, not necessarily because we are convinced that it's doing right, but we gain proficiency. I'm very good at this tool, so I don't want to let go of it because they're going to have to learn a different tool. And we're finding out that and you had mentioned AI, and again, a little digression here. When you get to the point where you can go to Claude Code and you can go ahead and make hundreds or even thousands of lines of functional code by just telling it what you want, the vibe coding. I know Ross has done some great vibe coding stuff when he published his book last year on cybersecurity's dirty secret on why budgets go to waste. He created all these tools online, and I said, yeah, and he wrote them all. And I said, I didn't know you're a web developer. And he says, well, I'm not, but I am now because AI is doing it, because he took the time to learn how to communicate effectively with AI. And so what we're going to see is that not only is AI going to play a role in our defense, but it's going to play a role in the attacker's offense because they're going to employ it against us as well. And as I had mentioned earlier, we have to move at the speed of AI. We no longer have the opportunity to sit back and think about things. So you had mentioned a couple times about where data lives, and that concept suggests that, first of all, we have to be able to inventory and know what's out there. But the hard part is doing this data discovery. If you've been tracking since day one, it's not so bad. In the military, we knew where all of our stuff pretty much was. If it was a secret document, it's going to be sitting in a safe unless you're actually working on it. In a room that only allows you to work on secret stuff, you don't walk around with it, you don't take it home with you, it just stays there. If it's top secret, you got to sign for it even just to hand it to somebody else, and there's all kinds of controls. But in most business organizations, we don't have those controls because they're not part of our culture, which then creates the issue to say, if we're getting serious about doing data discovery, we got to figure out where everything is, and we might be from a standing start. So how do we do that? Because we don't inherit a 98-99% solution.
Yeah. So first thing I would say about discovery is don't despair, because data discovery is a bridge painting, not portrait painting. Mm-hmm. Bridge painting, you finish the bridge, you turn around and start again, just go do it again. You go do it again, do it again. I think that when it comes to discovery, it's the same. We should be thinking about discovery is that you are always discovering your data. You are always discovering what is new and interesting and exciting and potentially dangerous inside of your environment. So I think that it has been hard for organizations because it has traditionally required more than one product, which meant just kind of you, as you were talking about before, you're going to have to learn more than one thing. You're going to have to be right-handed and left-handed. And that sometimes is very difficult. I think that there are too many organizations that are involved in discovery. So, you know, how do you start? You got to get consensus from business owners to, you can touch it, but don't screw with my data because this is my job. And, you know, data is the asset. Data is the, if it takes two clicks to protect your data and one click to do my job, then it's one click to always do my job, right? So. And I think lastly, in terms of the challenges with discovery is that data owners abdicate responsibility for data protections to their operations teams, which may or may not be a part of their organizations that are really hard today. So I think that the easiest thing to do with discovery is to start. And you should start by saying, I go to the finance drive of the finance department, and I'm going to start scanning there, and then I'm going to go to the connected servers within that environment, and maybe I'm going to go to the endpoints of the users who connect to those particular servers, and well, they also store data in the cloud. Well, then I'm going to go to those cloud sources. I think your strategy should just be around what you think is the most important data in your organization, and identify that and provide reality to it, and then just keep going. And when you're done, start again.
Sounds good. So they say the best time to plant a tree is 20 years ago. The second best time to plant a tree is today. And so if you've missed the first one, take the second one because you don't want to get down to the 20th or 30th or 40th choice. And so you're right. Just do it, if you will, if I can borrow a tagline from a vendor. Now, we talked and you'd mentioned a little bit about structured versus unstructured data. And then it creates an issue with regard to discovery as well as audit and things like that. Structured data, particularly like a database, pretty easy. It's got a bunch of spreadsheets, pretty easy. But when I have in a communications environment where I'm getting WhatsApp messages and Signal messages, and then I have emails coming in, and then voicemails coming in, and then someone's going to text me, and I'm going to get a little text message down here and things like that. I've got this diverse set of information. Any one of those places can have information that either needs to be protected because its sensitivity needs to be retained due to compliance requirements, or may represent a liability if people are, pushing around improper jokes in the corporate environment and those things end up in a discovery somewhere. So do we have a different approach for structured versus unstructured data, or do we just kind of wade into it and we just sort them out as we get to them one at a time?
So I have... I'd say it's a longer answer, but I think I've proven that every answer is a longer answer sometimes here. I think it is the same thing in the sense that if you are focusing on a particular goal, if you're focusing on HIPAA requirements or you're focusing on PII or whatever that happens to be, the PCI, you need to worry about the particular attributes of what that looks like. So you should scan for and protect against the particular aspects of that. Mm-hmm. It is certainly a different challenge when it comes to those various the channels that you were just talking about, because structured data is typically people come to the structured data. So you can provide protections around that data, both in terms of what they get to see, who gets to see it, and how they get to see it within that. And you can restrict if they can take it away or not. So that is, you know, that is a comfort in terms of that piece of it. The challenge with structured data is that usually in heavily regulated organizations, those structured data sets are gigantic and just onerous in terms of, I have millions of records and thousands of columns, and it's just hard to be able to get after it. Yeah. The other challenges that you need to have, I think, are about, simply, it's about the inputs and the outputs. So it's about the data that's on the line. You got to worry about finding what happens to be there, but you have to worry about it at its delivery. So if you're worrying about where data is landing and you're going to protect it as it's landing, that at least gives you some level of confidence that I know the inappropriate joke, or I know the inappropriate use of that credit card in that WhatsApp application that shouldn't have gone out within that particular way. So I think that it's hard, you know, it's hard to worry about sensitive, it's hard to worry about structured and unstructured when you're worrying about sensitive, but I think you just have to be diligent about looking at them as the same, because again, the headline is the same, whether it was a structured or unstructured breach, and the fine is probably the same also.
That's a very good insight, is that the nature of how that data is organized is independent of the risk. It's the content of that data, and whether it's a piece of paper with a bunch of sensitive information on it, or if it's a database, or it's a text message, it needs to be protected, it needs to be protected. Now, we've alluded a little bit, you had mentioned those two words, two letters, really, that we're dealing with now, A and I. And so what changes are you seeing? What role is AI playing in discovery, which is then potentially going to allow us to wade into this big sea, ocean, data lake of data and actually have some sort of chance at being able to identify and discover? But also, are there any risks involved that are unique to AI as well?
Yeah, so I think AI is the greatest single technology advance that I've seen in my lifetime. And just because it is, AI is your staff augmentation, right? It is the accelerator in terms of your ability to get things done. It is, your hundreds of little helpers that came into your organization that either write code when you couldn't write code, or write better code than the code that you used to write from before, or make the email sound better, or make the response better and be around. So the problem is that, the great news is that it does all those things. The problem is that it does what it's told and it doesn't have a conscience, right? So if it doesn't have a conscience, it can just do the right thing faster. It can do the wrong thing faster. It can identify things easier. It can make the effort more simple, but it can't replace good policy. So policy and data hygiene, I think, are the most important features that a data protection or data security organization, data policy should have, so as to ensure that the wrong things don't happen, right? The biggest risk of empowering AI, in my mind, is that it's going to solve a problem that you haven't figured out yet. So you're going to ask it to do something. It's going to take advantage of all the things that you've given it, and it's going to delete something that it shouldn't, or it's going to move something or send it somewhere that it shouldn't have been able to do, or consume or repurpose data that it really shouldn't have had access to. So I think that's really what the you know, to me, that's where your problem is that if you don't put good behavior in place beforehand, you don't have good data knowledge beforehand, then what you've done is you've introduced your small child in the kitchen and left the cabinets open and kind of thing.
Yeah, maybe the stove running as well and things such as that. So kind of last thought here for this conversation. And let's see, so I want to get serious about this. I realize I've inherited some sort of a mess and I need to get going. Just like somebody who says, I need to start an exercise program. I need to start a diet. I need to do something. What do you think is the first discovery win that CISO should aim for in, let's say, the first 90 days of going after this?
Well, I think that the result of your first 90 days is going to be, a report back to your board or report back to your executive within an organization. And so I think that within your first 90 days, you should identify where your data lives. Figure out where that happens to be. Identify what data you've chosen to keep in your organization. The good news and the bad news, what I've chosen to keep as an organization. Decide if that data should be kept in your organization and make sure you get rid of everything else. I've spent a lot of time today talking about how important discovery is. I think that retention is the great friend of discovery. I've heard it before. I say it a lot too, is that, data ages like milk. Data doesn't age like wine, it ages like milk, right? It's old data gets bad in a hurry. If the owners don't exist in your organization anymore, it gets leaked. So I think as a CISO coming in your first 90 days, knowing where your data is, knowing what that data is, knowing what you're storing, and deciding whether you should keep it or not is the fastest path to a happy life and continued employment. How about that?
Sounds really good. Well, Ross, let me ask you a couple of questions here. You've been waiting here patiently. One of the most useful tools for data security is, encryption. And so you, CISOs here, encrypt everything. If it's, kind of like in the Navy when we get someone at boot camp, they'd say, if it moves, salute it, and it doesn't move, paint it. Well, now we're saying if it moves, encrypt it, and if it doesn't move, encrypt it as well. What does it actually mean operationally when we have to encrypt everything?
Yeah, so let's start with the encryption in rest and encryption in transit, and then I'll give you the two areas that people often forget. So encryption in transit, we need TLS. We need good, strong ciphers to ensure when we send credit card information over the open internet at an airport or hotel, I don't want that to be easily captured on the wall of sheep like we would typically see in a DEFCON scenario. And encryption at rest. Well, if I leave my laptop in the Uber because I'm an idiot and someone gets access to my laptop, having something like a BitLocker encryption that prevents someone from easily stealing all the data on the laptop, also super important. Obviously, the big thing right now is people are starting to say, how do I get them post-quantum ready? And that'll be the next cipher we'll have to roll out to both of those scenarios. Now let's talk about the two places people often forget. The first is your test and QA servers. What I mean by that, there's a lot of big banks that have quality data in their production systems. Here's all the credit card data. And what they used to do, and this is kind of like a dirty secret of cybersecurity, they would remove the name of the user, but then put everything else in the dev and QA environment. So we're talking addresses, we're talking, payment card information, all their socials, any of that know your customer sensitive banking information. And so a smart attacker might just say, let me steal the data backups because they're not encrypted and I can take them out on a Friday and copy them all before Sunday when they have to go back. And then nobody's the wiser except for I'm the richer for having stolen said data. So that was like a no-go. And the banking industry said, we got to stop that. And so they started saying, make sure you encrypt your non-prod networks. And so I use tools like PKWare at Capital One and Caterpillar Financial in order to minimize those threats, as well as make sure that I'm complying with the appropriate laws and regulations. And then the other piece that I'll also say is kind of the forgotten secret are these things like S3 buckets and other places you may store data on your apps. And so I was at Capital One, and one of the things exposed through the breach is we actually had cardholder PDF data, you know, think of like your monthly reports sitting in S3 buckets for US and Canadian citizens. And so we had to pay a fine. We had to go fix those things. So making sure that you don't just encrypt the app, but you encrypt all the places that that app data may have moved to, also super, super important.
Now, when we encrypt stuff, it's not just, well, it seems like a good idea. There's often something that's driving that. And so we have compliance and regulations and things like that. What regulations might affect a CISO that requires data encryption for compliance?
Yeah, so I come from the banking industry, you know, working at the Federal Reserve, working at Capital One, Caterpillar Financial. So you're going to hear the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act, GLBA. You're also going to hear PCI, payment card industry. There's the PCI data security standard that's very common to come up. Also the healthcare industry, right? We don't want to lose all our, you know, medical information and have that easily exposed. So HIPAA and HITRUST are really going to force that. It's really just something you're going to see in every NIST standard of encrypt, 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 right?
And so, yeah, and that's going to depend upon our organization that we're in or even the department we're in. HR may be facing with stuff, but other parts might not be having that sensitive information and things like that. But if we look at things like we had talked before, DLP early in the show, data loss prevention and encryption, what's the relationship between DLP and encryption? Do they complement themselves? Do they overlap? Are they independent? What do you think?
Yeah, so think of DLP like the bars that keep prisoners from escaping the prison, right? And what you really need is some type of data labeling to say what data can go in and out of the bars with the keys, right? Now, encryption, you still have to have it. You have to have it at rest. You have to have it in transit. But the honest truth is if the bad actor already has the keys to the server, they're probably going to be able to decrypt the data. So you really need both, because if the bad actor gets on the server and steals the data, but the DLP catches it and said, well, this data should never go in this direction, that's a really nice defense in depth approach. So I think you absolutely need encryption to comply with the regulations. There's also regulations that require DLP, but having multiple safeguards that work in tandem when you have insider threats, when you have unknown vulnerabilities, that's the stuff that really helps you quickly detect something bad is happening.
Good point. Now, you've had a chance to use solutions like PKWare to protect sensitive data in your banking career. Can you talk about your experience there, about protecting both information at rest and in motion?
Yeah. So when I was at Caterpillar Financial, we had walked in and we had an opportunity to do better encryption in our non-prod environments. And so we did, you know, a vendor evaluation at the time, and we found that PKWare was just a really solid product. It had been something I had previously exposed with at Capital One. And so we decided to use it. And essentially what we were able to do is take our database fields in our non-prod environments and, let's say, mask them. So instead of Ross Young and all Ross's sensitive data, it says John Doe and John Doe information. And you think this would be an easy problem, right? But the problem is you often have 10 different systems that all work together. Here's, you know, the database, but then that's also different from the insurance tool. That's also different from the credit score lookup. So you actually need a system that's actually smart enough to know that even though we have Ross Young in three different places, it's the same Ross Young, so that when we mask it, it looks like only John Doe and not Fred Smith and John Doe and whoever, right? And so having these robust solutions that have that support all the different types of databases, because, you know, you may have a Mongo database and that's different from a SQL database, that's different from the all the other things that are there, that support is massive. And then I would also say maybe the other thing that I was sick of was having to buy yet another tool, right? I don't think any cyber professional loves having to go to procurement 80 times a year to get 80 different vendors. If I can get one vendor who does, you know, 10 different functions, that saves me time away from procurement. That saves me time from having to integrate 20 different tools or products and send data. And so having a solution that solves that, super important to me as a CISO.
Got it. And that makes very good sense, because otherwise it's really tough to build a data-centric approach if you're constantly standing in line with a request to say, can I get another tool, please? Now, EJ, back to you and some thoughts about some things that we're seeing. How do you prevent leakage when your data is being shared across apps, APIs, partners, things such as that? It's no longer just the employee problem. It's bigger than that.
I think that vigilance with your data flows is probably the biggest win in terms of that part of the story. So understanding how applications are consuming your information and how you are sharing that information to other applications, as Ross was just kind of talking about. I love that Ross had nice things to say. That was great. But it's also important, like the problems that he was talking about of multiple systems requiring, you know, consistent masking or masking of particular users across the way. That same application or that same diligence is required when you're dealing with APIs and sharing with partners and going across applications. So, you know, encryption is an important method of providing security within that area. But just again, as Ross has kind of talked about, masking and obfuscation to me are not only acceptable, but they're in some ways better technologies in that method, because once you've obfuscated or masked the data, it's no longer part of your risk profile, because that data is no longer real. So, you know, encryption data can be decrypted, which means that it's still part of the PCI rules and standards that we're talking about. But if it's been masked, it's not. So you are reducing a surface. You're making it easier for your ability, your application owners and your developers to build applications and share it freely. It's just that the data is no longer at risk.
You know, one of the challenges I face as a CISO, and probably a lot of other CISOs as well, is protecting the data flowing into AI systems and large language models and the like. Any advice in that area?
I think it's kind of the same what we were just talking about with this, the sharing of data. I think that, again, knowing, you should know your information before you're allowing your LLM or your AI systems to be able to consume them. So knowing what data your systems have access to and protecting them in whatever way that it happens to be. A simple protection is applying sensitivity labels that, you know, provide restriction to the data that gets to be able to be moved. And so if you can't open up that data, if you can't have access to it, that is one of the simplest ways of being able to do it. Encryption is certainly another way that it can't be consumed, and reducing that. So I think that knowing your data, I feel like we're on that same thread that I keep talking about all the time here, but I think it's, you know, really having vigilance around visibility is the best path for keeping your AI systems from taking over your good intentions and providing you to put on the front page of any story that happens to be there.
Yeah, got it. Ross, what are your thoughts on this?
You know, I think it comes down to, if you don't manage access to your data, you have all sorts of problems. And I'll just give a tale of two stories. There's the application where you have to use a SailPoint identity access solution to get role-based permissions to access the data. That type of system, you probably have really good access control on those systems. The other system that is maybe not the great system is everything we've done on share drives and SharePoint and all these other places, where instead of having a central place where it had to have a two-person review, it was, hey, I'm just going to share this file over here with all my friends in my division or other things. And then I lose, you know, my role, and I go to a different part of the organization. And I still kept all my old permissions. And so when that AI is trained on a ton of bad permissions, and now it starts to see that, oh, look, the chief financial officer just, you know, shared everything with the whole financial department or with the whole company internally. And usually I wouldn't find that on my own, but since AI knows where to find it, it's a lot simpler to kind of reveal these like dirty, bad accesses we've had for years and years and years. So I think this is a problem that is too big for one person to clean up. I mean, if I was a CISO and I told every manager at Caterpillar to go, you know, fix their access permissions, they'd all tell me go pound sand, right? But what I think we have to do is say, well, what is the automated solution that looks for all this data and says, here's PII, PCI, PHI, any of these data types, and says, oh, it can't be shared with the entire company. That is just too far of a blast radius, and starts to remove those types of over-permissioned data sprawls as we have. I think that's a big, big piece of what we're going to have to do to get AI security correct.
Do you think, are we going to enter an era where this data loss prevention gives way to data misuse prevention?
Nice. What do you think? I think that that's a nice flow. I think that data policy is going to drive, data policy needs to drive data behavior, which then will drive your DLP in terms of those pieces. So I think that if we, if our strategy for data loss is worrying about discovery and protection first, then DLP becomes that last and last confident assurance that we had. You know, Ross used that analogy earlier about the bars in the prison for the people. I think that you want to make sure that that's the last chance for somebody as opposed to anything before that.
So, got it. So a couple last things here as we wrap up today. How about test data? Ross had mentioned a little bit about that. In fact, two approaches. One is you can obfuscate test data. The problem there is that it lives in different systems and it has different identifiers. And if you don't get it all, you might leak something. And plus you have the problem that it might not accurately represent what you're trying to do in the system. So you're not going to get the same performance. And the other approach is protect your test systems to the same level of fidelity that you're going to protect your production systems, which means that they're not going to, you know, that test data, although it's not real, so to speak, doesn't matter if you have the same controls here that you have here. And we've already figured out the controls. Is that over-engineering a solution or is that some wisdom that we could follow?
I think it's wisdom, number one. So I'm going to go, I'll first give you the credit, Mark, that we're talking about wisdom. I think that the only challenge that exists with test data is that you don't really know who your users are of that data. So worrying about permission sometimes defeats the purpose of people being able to use testing for it. Mm-hmm. So if you have been able to make better decisions around the data itself and neutering that data, if you will, then maybe the users have a better chance. But I do think that people shouldn't think about it differently than they think about production. I think it is as important and probably the single easiest place that users or organizations can go to lose data.
Got it. So, EJ, thanks again for sharing your comments, your ideas. It's been a great conversation. Now, if somebody wanted to learn a little bit more about what your ideas are or your products and things like that to talk more about what we've discussed, how would they get in touch with you and the PKWare team?
So the best place to get information about PKWare is from our website, the www.pkware.com. On it, it is broken down both by products, by solutions, and by use cases. So I would say that that's the first thing to do. On that site, you can easily click a button and ask for a demo and ask for to speak to a person. I can be one of those people that you speak to, but if people are looking to talk to me directly, it's ej.pappas@pkware.com. Happy to chat, happy to talk.
Well, got it. EJ, thanks again. And for our audience out there, if you've learned something great today or interesting today, do us a favor. Let other people know where you get your CISO tradecraft. You can either go ahead and post some comments to us on LinkedIn, make some comment in our YouTube if you're watching us or in your favorite podcast channel. And that's going to help other people find us with a little bit more ease so they can improve their security as well. Nobody likes having the data stolen, so anything you can do to help somebody else out will go a long way. And also, don't forget to check out PKWare, PKWARE.com, or EJ.Pappas, P-A-P-P-A-S, at PKWare.com if you want to follow up. Fantastic time we've had here. I think it's been wonderful. I think you'll enjoy the follow-up that you have as well. And thank you again for making that kind offer of making yourself available to our listeners and our watchers. So thank you, everybody, for being part of CISO Tradecraft. And until next time, stay safe out there.